Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on a Getaway Friday, May the 1st, May Day, 2026. 13, coming up on 14 minutes past the hour. And I hope you're having a great morning wherever you are. But we are joined in the studio this morning by, actually, it's hard to believe, somebody we've never had on the program before, but I have talked to at several events that have went on throughout Marion here. Actually, Governor Celeste book tour, I think, was the last time we got together. He is a member of the Democratic Party. He's worked with Mary Ellen Withrow, and we are glad to have him here in the studio this morning. Greg Haas. Now, Greg, would we call you a Democratic strategist? Is that a...
That's usually what they call me, but, you know, just don't call me late for dinner.
Now, what is the difference between a strategist, a pundit, a member of the Democratic Party? What are the differences?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of times they use the word strategist for people who are still working in the field, whereas a pundit is usually, you know, a reference to somebody who's sitting in the stands watching with everybody else, but has a lot of experience, and so, you know, they're drawn to them. And I think, you know, there are no set rules or anything like that, but I think, you know, strategist is oftentimes, you know, a reference to people who are still active in the field.
What brought you to the Democratic Party? What makes you a Democrat?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and I hope you give me some leeway on the time, because it's a, you know, I do think that had I been born in a different time, I would have been a Republican. If I'd been born, you know, in the Civil War, post-Civil War era, I think I would have been a Republican. But you know, growing up after the Great Depression and the Roosevelt years, I saw a party that was committed to people. And the thing I admire most about the Democratic Party is that it doesn't even seek to brag about the fact, you know, a lot of times people think that Democrats are, you know, pro women's lib to get women to vote for them, or that they're pro civil rights to get African Americans to vote for them, or to pro gay rights to get the gay community to vote for them. But the reality is, with all of those groups, the party, you know, lost an incredible number of votes. I mean, Lyndon Johnson said after the passing of the Civil Rights Act, "We'll never carry a state south of the Mason-Dixon line again." And for 50 years, he was right. You know, it's willing to sacrifice for the greater good, and a lot of times it doesn't defend itself on that, and it should. So, I mean, I think it's the values, it's the idea that we're all in this together. You know, I have not seen a Democratic leader who, once they hold office, believes that they only represent Democrats. But I've seen a lot of Republican leaders who believe that they're the president of the Republican voters, or the governor of Republican voters. When it, you know, in reality, when Democrats serve, you know, I did all Mayor Mike Coleman's campaigns in Columbus, and, you know, he was always fond of saying, you know, a pothole isn't a Democratic pothole, a Republican pothole, an independent pothole. It's a pothole. And we have a responsibility, you know, to make government work for people. And so I, you know, it's that belief that the rising tide raises all boats, that we invest in the poor. You know, Will Rogers used to say, you know, if you give a dollar to a poor man at six in the morning, by three in the afternoon, the rich guy is going to have it. And that's, there's a lot of truth in that. And I think that ultimately the people who tend to contrast the parties miss is that it's about the bottom up, not the top down. And that's really the core of the contrast. I mean, the trickle down is at the core of Republican philosophy. They really believe that running government in the interest of billionaires is in the interest of everybody. And I don't share that belief at all. I think that our economy is built from the bottom up, not the top down. Mm.
Let's go back a little bit. Tell us about your childhood, growing up, what you wanted to be.
Strangely enough, I was born actually on Bell Fountain Avenue in Oakland Heights. And when my dad died, we moved to small town Fredericktown, Ohio, because my mom wanted a place where the entire town would be watching me because, you know, I was a little ornery. And as early as the third grade, I had a passionate interest in politics. I think partly it came from my dad dying and then the assassination of JFK were really close together. I think some of that blurred in my mind. It was always a joke about how I took one of those maps of the United States where each of the states is like a puzzle. And my mom looks at them election night and there's numbers on all of them. And she's like, what is this? And I'm in the third grade. I said, it's the Electoral College. And, you know, when they announce states, you know, I'm going to put them. I was doing what Tim Russert basically did with a legal pad with a little puzzle. So there was just this natural addiction to it that I had that I've been, you know, completely fascinated by politics my entire life.
How did you get into the field?
Well, I sometimes joke when I speak to a high school class or a university class about my whole life is a high school civics project that got out of control. It had started before my senior year in high school, but where I really dove in was in campaigns and in politics in 1972, and got a real taste for it. Developed some great people, a fellow by the name of George Breithaupt and a few other folks that mentored me helped lead me into politics. And I was a political consultant before there was the name political consultant. I mean, you know, Jerry Austin and I ran several Ohio campaigns and Jesse Jackson's campaign. Always joke that he was the first political consultant, I was the second. But we were doing that. We were doing that business even before the title was out there.
What does a political consultant do? If you're running Jesse Jackson's campaign or the political consultant for that campaign, what are you doing?
Well, you're working 80 to 100 hours a week. Are responsible, you know, ultimately for every detail, everything that happens in the campaign. The buck stops there. You can't let it go up to the candidate. If something goes wrong, you know, you got to bite the bullet. I think that, it's about making sure the biggest thing and the best description of this I ever heard in my life was actually at an independent forum that had Lee Atwater, who ran George H.W. Bush's campaign. And he described it as there's a three-ring circus, and in one ring you have all the operations of a campaign, all the work, the volunteers, the mailings, the things that go on. In the second ring you have all the tactics of the campaign, the ads that you put up, the things. And then the third ring is the most important to the consultant, which is the strategy of the campaign. And he said, you know, and we wanted to make George H.W. Bush the strong leader against a guy who was a weak leader. And that was the entire strategy. Everything we did, it was the strategist's job to make sure that that strategy reflected in some way. If you remember in 92, I ran Ohio for Bill Clinton. James Carville had the, you know, the great line, it's the economy, stupid. Well, that was the strategy in that campaign. And it was, you know, his job to make sure that we were hitting on that message. Even if we were talking about healthcare, we would bring it back to the economy. You know, we would talk about the loss of jobs because American-made products had to pay for healthcare, and European and Asian countries, by and large, didn't have to because they paid for their healthcare through the government, and that created a trade disadvantage. And so we would relate every issue that came up back to that strategy, and that comes from the consultant and from the strategist, and is passed down throughout the rest of the campaign.
You know, Bill Clinton is an interesting story for people who remember back to 92. George H.W. Bush, the father, was the sitting president. Mm-hmm. That gives you an advantage. Mm-hmm. He had something like a 90% approval rating after the Iraq War.
Right.
No Democrat, including the one who everybody thought was going to run, Cuomo, father Mario Cuomo, wanted to run against him.
Right.
Clinton got in there, and he certainly had his picadillos with women right off the bat.
Yep.
And yet, he was able to not only get the party's nomination, he won the election in what people would call a landslide, and he carried Ohio in those days.
Yep.
What, working, running the Clinton campaign in Ohio, what did he have?
Well, first of all, he had the ability to relate to people. My story on him was, I wanted to work for Cuomo. But a friend of mine was running the Clinton campaign, and as Cuomo was dragging it out, I agreed to sign on. And I'd met Bill Clinton 4 years earlier and was impressed, but I hadn't, you know, there was still part of my heart that was like, gosh, I wish Mario would have run. And we had a, right after the Jennifer Flowers thing, you know, the campaign went bust for a while, and we had a major fundraiser for Clinton that was, you know, a number of people. Lee Fisher led the way, came up with a lot of money to fund the campaign at the worst possible time. Now, most candidates that you know, and we were coming down the elevator and we were walking out, and we had not had any kind of retail event in the state, anything where it was meeting a lot of people. So I had everybody on the phones having people meet him in the Rife lobby, and there ended up being like 300 people who wanted to come and see him. He was more fascinated, and he spent more time shaking hands in that crowd than he actually did up in the room shaking hands, raising money. But the most striking thing was, a lot of people who are familiar with Columbus, and I'll bet you will know this person, Scott. There's a guy named Brad who had no arms, hands, and he would sit in front of the state office tower, rock back and forth with a little pot in front of him. What a lot of people didn't know about Brad was he was very smart about politics. I had many conversations with him. He was hard to understand. You know, they thought he was mentally retarded, so he was raised in a state hospital, and he, you know, had hygiene issues because, you know, he's got no arms, right? Well, he figures out the van that Clinton's going to be in and gets himself in a position where he's going to be able to see Clinton up close. As we're getting in the van, Clinton sees Brad, and he walks over to him, and he and Brad are talking, and Brad is very short. He's looking up with his neck completely back. And Clinton put his hands through the matted, oily hair and held Brad's head as he was talking to him, and probably spent more time talking to Brad than anybody else. And he had that human connection that was real. You can't fake it. Not to that degree. I mean, he loved people, and that paid him, that saved him in his dark hours, because people could sense it about him. And if it's, you know, a lot of people try and fake that kind of thing, but it always shows that they're faking.
Mm. Donald Trump. The same state that Clinton won handily twice, mm-hmm. Ohio, Barack Obama won handily twice.
Yep.
Donald Trump has won rather handily three times. How can that be? What does Donald Trump have that that other Republicans have not had to this degree.
Yeah, he's got a connection with people who have felt lost in the system, and frankly, there are a lot of them that have a legitimate complaint with the party, and because we haven't communicated well, we haven't demonstrated how we've been fighting, even for the people who oppose us. Think back to the two $1,000 checks that people got during COVID. Now, all of the Republicans were fighting for that money to go to the top, to go to the businesses, so that they would lower prices, just like we just did in terms of the bailout over. But the Democrats, led by Pelosi, fought to get a chunk of that money directly to people. Now, and they were smart enough to go to Donald Trump and say, look, you know, you can put your name on the check, which got them Trump and therefore got those two $1,000 checks that went out to everybody. So while a lot of these people were seeing these checks with Donald Trump's name on them, they had no idea that it was the Democrats who actually fought to get them those checks. And so we haven't done a good job of communicating with those folks. But the second thing is there's a terrible mistake that's made time and again by everybody about always looking at every issue that it looks like a race-based issue and not recognize that it's also a class-based issue. You know, for instance, the driving while black, okay? Now, there's no question that a black man in a Mercedes can get pulled over, particularly in a lot of suburbs and places like that, solely because he's black, and it's completely wrong. But the problem that where that kind of issue catches you is, but also a lot of poor people can tell you that if you're driving through a suburb or something in a beat up car, you're much more likely to get pulled over. So it's, you know, there's the race issue, but there's also a class issue. And we never talk about the class issues that are out there, except Donald Trump does. I mean, Donald Trump in negative ways speaks to those folks who are hurting and whose life has declined. I mean, we can see it clearly here in Marion, you know, where there's been a decline in the middle class. There's frustration. People's kids, if they're ambitious, leave the state, and so there's a longing for the good old days. And Republicans do a good job of saying, you know, we'll take you back to Mayberry, we'll take you back to the good old days, when in fact, you know, of course they can't. I like to think that our good old days are still ahead of us. You know, we just got to work towards it.
When did you meet Mary Ellen Withrow?
I met her in 1981, when she was just talking about running for state treasurer. Now, I know for sure that our lives had crossed paths before that. Years later, after working for her and being, you know, very friendly with her family and everyone, we found out that Norman was our mailman. And so there were connections that predated that, I'm sure, but she was in high school with my sister, and so there was, you know, there were connections. One day she mentions my dad had a restaurant on Center Street, where City Hall is now, and it was actually on Union, she used to eat in there quite a bit. And so, you know, there was a lot of overlap over the years. Then the first time, in 1982, I ran the field operation for ODP, and she was the main focus in the final couple weeks of the campaign. So I worked a lot, helping her campaign. But then in 86, she and the state party chair were concerned because a fellow by the name of Jeff Jacobs, who could self-fund to the max, he had just been credited with opening up the flats in Cleveland, and his dad had just saved the Indians, So there was a lot of momentum behind the name, and they poured a lot of money, and they hired the guy referred to as Mr. Unbeatable. His name was Roger Stone, and he had a long list of victories against Democrats. But Jeff was able to, because he had enough money, he was able to hire Stone. And we were the first state, Mary Ellen was the first person to break his streak, even though she was outspent 3-1, even though, you know, he had this boost in Cleveland. It was a great campaign.
What did she have? Because when you look at it now, this is the treasurer of Marion County,
mm-hmm.
you know, 65,000 people in Marion County,
right.
and ran against six men,
right.
recently looked at those election results in
yep.
the primary.
Yep.
She wins.
Yep.
Then she faces the treasurer of Franklin County, Buck Reinhardt,
right.
Who obviously Franklin County, a lot bigger than Marion County,
right.
and wins that election.
Yep.
What did she have to be able to do that?
Well, you know, one thing that I've always admired about Mary Ellen is that while she was strongly, you know, committed to pro-choice, she was strongly committed to a lot of, you know, a lot of the issues affecting women, but she was also very comfortable being kind of a maternal leader, which I think is the message for women candidates, particularly nationally. Because what we've tried to do with both Harris and Hillary is run them as paternal leaders. I mean, Hillary was one of the biggest Democratic cheerleader for the second war in Iraq. I mean, she was a tough, you know, I'm going to be, you know, as tough as any man when it comes to foreign policy. That rubs people the wrong way. And I think it, particularly after COVID, particularly after, you know, we had a number of states run by women that did far better in COVID than states run by men. We were lucky to have Amy Acton in Ohio. And people are, I think people are wanting that maternal leadership. And so it's running more as a maternal leader and not being afraid of that.
Well, this is an interesting point that I've never understood, because I think anybody, and I've talked with Mary Ellen about this, who looked at her success statewide and as treasurer of the United States, being a woman seemed to work for her. Mm-hmm. People liked the way she looked. They liked the way she dressed. They liked the way she talked and liked the way she governed.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, Hillary and Kamala Harris have both said in their election fallout books that being a woman hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
So why did it hurt them but helped Mary Ellen in a state in which we still have not had an elected female governor?
Right.
And Mary Ellen, as you know, in those days, was being courted to run for governor.
I was leading the charge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why did it work for her even in that era?
Well, part of that is the office. I mean, and you brought up the courting, I'm glad you brought that up, because we ran head on into the sex discrimination, even within our own party, you know, that people didn't think a woman could win in 1994. So, you know, they dreamed of, you know, the perfect candidate coming in, but they ended up with Rob Birch. You know, I think that, you know, had she been the candidate, I don't think she would have beaten George Voinovich, but she would have kept it close enough that we held on to some House seats and Lee Fisher would have won and a couple other statewide candidates would have won. But so there was that glass ceiling in Ohio, like, okay, state treasurer, but you know, not governor, even with Democrats in 1994. The second thing is, obviously, and this is the crux of what I talk about with paternal and maternal leadership kind of stuff, is that that the temptation, you know, the fear that a lot of people raise is, will she be tough enough? Will she you know, be willing to have people killed, you know, and both Hillary and Harris hit that too hard. It should have been a passing point that they made, that they'll protect Americans no matter what. Not that they'll lead the charge into battle, but they'll but their first duty is to protect Americans, and they'll do that at all costs. And taking it more, you know, I mean, it was the strategist. And I would have made the same mistake. This is hindsight with Hillary and with Harris. Hopefully it doesn't happen to Acton, because she is such a good, genuine person that they don't try and doctor that by trying to, you know, demonstrate that you know, she's tough enough for the job, because that's the internal thing that happens. You know, you want to, the instinct by everybody has been to try and make the woman look tough. The more you do that, the more people see that you're pushing, they see that's, and it looks phony. And then it turns people off. You know, Mary Ellen was always herself, you know, and she did not put on phony airs. She did not, I mean, and being genuine and real is the most effective way to communicate with people. You know, like we talked about earlier with Bill Clinton, having that is the greatest strength.
Well, I'm interested to get this opinion about Amy Acton from a political consultant, because I have told Mary Ellen this, and obviously through the years with her moving back here, we've become closer, and it's always great to have her on as a panelist in whatever show we're doing. But I've told her that even when she was Treasurer of the United States, if you were in the media in Marion and you called her office, you could get her.
Yeah.
And if it was something she couldn't talk about, because there were those cases,
sure. She
would say, I can't talk about this. Yeah. As soon as I can, I will let you know.
Yeah.
So the media always appreciated that.
Yeah.
Dr. Acton is an interesting case when it comes to the media.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get your opinion on this. She does rallies.
Mm-hmm.
She apparently is drawing big crowds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I witnessed it.
But does not invite the media to cover these events. And when we try to get in, we're told, not a media event. And she also does not do a lot of interviews.
Mm-hmm.
I have had her on twice, and I've said David Pepper negotiated that. But I've looked around. There aren't a lot of interviews with mm-hmm. her, with mm-hmm. reporters.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that is?
It's a good question, and I was not aware of it until you brought it up. I was simply, you know, my observations were just of her on the stump and watching her speak. And if I were doing her campaign, I would certainly have no hesitation with allowing her to be interviewed as often as possible. And I would want as much media. I mean, I was in Perry County with Dick Celeste. I went back to my roots. I was his driver in 1977. And so I drove him around Ohio. Unfortunately, an 87-year-old man with a broken kneecap wore me out. But we went to this rally in Perry County, and there were minimally 160, 180 people in that little county in Shawnee, Ohio, that were excited to see her, enjoyed her, you know, and so somehow she's building that word of mouth network. I'll be interested to see how that plays out. I mean, whether that continues to be the case. I can't believe that it will. I mean, to me, that kind of sounds like that might be a operational misstep. Now, they just brought in the communications director. I can't think of her name. But I bet that changes.
Well, it's interesting because this recent story about the police being called to her home in 2019,
right.
Which a lot of people said, listen, this is a married couple.
Right.
Even if she did break the mirror, which was in the police report,
right.
You know, she had a glass of wine, she had a drink.
Right.
Couples have spats.
Yeah.
This is 7 years ago.
Yeah.
But she never spoke about it. She sent her campaign manager out to speak about it. She sent her husband out to speak about it, in quotes. Eventually, David Pepper came on, and we did speak to him about it.
Yeah.
She never did.
Yeah.
And you would think that story could have been handled if she would have came out the next day and spoken to somebody and just said, hey.
Well, now on that one, I'm not sure. I'm not sure that I agree with you about the necessity of her talking about it. I think it was important that her husband did. She at some point should just, you know, own up that she regrets it and all of that. But the problem is that, you know, the Republicans are going to set on every phrase about that situation, every angle, and, you know, the possibility of taking something out of context, and turning it into an ad, would be something that I would be very, if I were her communications director, I'd have been very concerned about. And I think I would have probably voted on letting other people handle it in the short term, because, you know, I mean, we've got the Epstein file out there that's buried to protect men who raped little children. We have volumes of really serious crimes. We have in Ohio, we have an energy company that was able to negotiate paying for a nuclear power plant in Indiana with Ohio ratepayers' money. I mean, that's corruption. I think the public is responding to that incident with that in context. I mean, understanding that, you know, it was a spat, she lives in a middle class neighborhood where people were on top of each other. They're not giant yards. She lives in Bexley, but she lives in a part of Bexley where the houses are small, you know, modest comparatively, and so you know. You could see where, you know, a family could be having a dispute that, you know, got somebody alarmed, but is kind of part of every home, you know, I mean, sooner or later.
You know, I think one of the fears there, though, is that eventually she is going to speak to a reporter,
mm-hmm.
and the reporter, of course, is going to ask about that,
mm-hmm.
and then it's just going to bring it up again.
Right.
And I think that's why a lot of people felt she should have spoken out in the beginning.
That would have been part of, you know, like when you do something like this, you do the pluses and minuses and of whether you say something or whether you have her say something or not, and certainly in terms of that, but I think the assumption was, and probably safely, that because it's the only thing they got, it's not going to go away. It's going to be part of advertising. It's going to be part of their campaign because they don't have any, you know, anything really else to talk about. So you're not going to diffuse it. You're not going to get rid of it. I mean, certainly there's a lot of times where there's an issue that comes up that you can get rid of by just addressing it. But, you know, they're going to bring it up. They're going to use it in advertising. But I think treating it as something that's not effective is the best way to go. And I think you're right. I mean, she is going to have to say that, you know, she regrets that it had ever happened. I don't know that she needs to say any more than that.
Who is the top of the Democratic ticket in Ohio? Because we certainly have seen the down ticket vote grow more in recent years than it used to be. But most people would have thought common wisdom would have been Sherrod Brown.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I got a mailer this morning I was talking about for Randy Weston, And who's on the flyer? Amy Acton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so who is the head of this ticket? Is it Sherrod or is it Amy?
That, you know, I mean, that's a great question, which hopefully we've got the people who can negotiate out the campaigns. And this is what I did in 92, because John Glenn was in the fight of his life in 92. And when Bill Clinton was running, and we had, you know, I mean, fortunately, both the principals were very good at working together and that kind of stuff. Some states, that is not the case. And, you know, I think Al Franken got run out of Minnesota or got run out of the Senate because Amy Klobuchar was tired of being second fiddle. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, there was a day when John Glenn and Howard Metzenbaum were at each other's throat. Mary Rose Okar and Congressman Stokes, you know, I mean, so you have those in campaigns, and they can be very difficult. And so I think that Sherrod's going to have to do the hardest thing for a guy who was the only Democrat to hold office in Ohio, and has been the center of the storm in the fight for a number of elections now, to step back a step and recognize that Amy's the top of the ticket. That you know, it's always struck me as a strange thing, but people do not get motivated to turn out to vote for legislative races, but they will turn out to vote for mayor, for governor, and for president. And I think one, you know, if you think about it, everybody who is involved in public education, everybody who's involved in a lot of different fields are directly impacted by the governor. You know, a senator is one of 100. I think we ran into this in the last election where we didn't have the top of the ticket battling in Ohio. Harris was barely here. And they didn't put the, you know, infrastructure in, and I think our turnout drop compared to other states. I mean, there was a gigantic difference in turnout in Cleveland as compared to Detroit. You know, that comes from not having a top of the ticket, and so I think that, you know, we need Amy to win big, and if she wins big, Sherrod wins. If Sherrod wins big, everybody else could lose, because, you know, he's just, you know, he's not turning votes out. If she wins big, it's because she's turning votes out.
Got to talk about Vivek Ramaswamy, because this has been a fascinating year.
Mm-hmm.
If you would have went to people a year ago and said, who's going to win this gubernatorial race? Hands down, most people would have said Vivek Ramaswamy. He had Trump's endorsement. Mm-hmm. The party endorsed him early. Dave Yost was out of the race.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Tressel did not end up running. This was the guy.
Yeah.
And in a year, he now has a primary challenge, which newspapers are saying this week from Casey Putch, that, you know, Casey's not going to win that primary, but that he's gaining some traction. He's going to get a somewhat decent percentage.
Yeah.
And I have talked to many Republicans who Jim Renacci being one of them, who ran for governor last time around.
Mm-hmm.
And he has said that he has had private conversations with Vivek about his religion. Being a Hindu is going to be a problem in Ohio.
Absolutely.
People have said that his name is going to be a problem in Ohio. Somebody wrote Frank LaRose and posted it on social media, which is where we get a lot of stuff. Is Vivek eligible to run for governor? Nothing to do with the man's policies at all. Now, people have problems with those, but this all seems to be dovetailing around the man's race and not doing any good for him. Is race an issue?
Yeah. I mean, it was an issue for Ken Blackwell. It was less of an issue. It's less of an issue for a Democrat running because, but more of an issue for a Republican running, because there are a chunk of Republican voters who, you know, are not going to vote for a person of color. Not by no stretch the majority, but a significant chunk. But I think that the bigger problem is people have gotten to see Vivek closer and closer. The more clear it is that what is he doing in Ohio? I mean, he takes his company and moves it to Texas. He's on his Lear to New York and D.C. At the drop of a hat. Before he started to run for office, was he ever at a Reds game or an Indians game or a Guardians game or a Cavalier game? I just talked to somebody who saw him at the Guardian or at the Cavs game a few nights ago in the front row, and I said to him, I wonder if that's the first time he's ever been to a Cavs game. Has he ever been, before he was running for governor, has he ever been to a county fair? Has he ever, sat in the cheap seats in Cooper Stadium or, he hasn't because he's not, he picked it, because it looked like a good place for him to run. It shows through. There's this, he's not an Ohioan. I tell you, this has driven me crazy with everybody who's run for governor since Dick Celeste. And that is that when I cut my teeth, Jim Rhodes, Vern Reif, Dick Celeste, had these great, great examples of how to lead from all three of them. But one thing they had in common is everybody would say about him, well, I know he loves Ohio. And having, Dick Celeste would wear those weird glasses with the O on both sides and the H-I in the middle. And, and he would go out to a county fair and have a blast, and that paid off with people. And we've got in Ohio, I think it's a justifiable chip on our shoulder that, we're a flyover state and that our contribution to this country is not fully appreciated. This could be the first land on the planet that slavery was banned. Ohio has this great history and yet, we're blown off, by Texas and, California and New York and even our neighboring states. And we've got a little bit of a chip on our shoulder and saying and making it clear to Ohioans that just like they do, you love this state. You want to be here. You want to fight for it because you care about it. Campaigns have not been doing that lately, and I don't understand it. I do not understand how they're missing that because it's just such a gigantic part of it. And I really believe that Amy, because of her history, because of being homeless, because of how she has to fight to move up to become a doctor, and she credits Ohio with basically saving her. That's going to play well, exceptionally well with people, and she can very naturally, be the biggest Buckeye fan. If we ever have an I-71 World Series, set on both sides of the field somehow. But just be, an Ohioan, be proud of being an Ohioan, love this state. Don't move your factory to Texas from Ohio if you love Ohio.
You know what's interesting in this gubernatorial race? You've got Mike DeWine, our sitting governor, two-term governor.
Yeah.
A lot of Democrats spoke very highly of him during COVID and how he handled that. And here he is.
Until he didn't.
And he's on his way out, and he's got this governor's race of who's going to succeed him. And on one side is his health director, who was there during COVID.
Right.
And on the other side is the Republican, the party he's been a part of all his life. He has endorsed Vivek Ramaswamy, but every time Ramaswamy runs an ad dinging Amy Acton, which they did recently, that she shut down the primaries in 2020, who came out to defend her first?
Yep.
Mike DeWine, and denounced the ad.
Yeah.
How big of a liability is that for the Ramaswamy campaign?
Well, I tell you, I would give anything to be able to look over his shoulder and see how Governor DeWine votes, because I have a funny feeling that a lot of Republicans would be upset. You know, he's got this fascinating history, and there's a Mike DeWine that I really like. I mean, you know, Mike DeWine was one of the few Republicans that voted for the assault weapons ban. I mean, Mike DeWine, now he's, of course, Mr. NRA, and he's done that, which he kind of did the same thing with COVID. I have nothing to base this on, but I kind of think when he's listening to his wife and they're talking, he's a really good governor. But when he's listening to his political consultants and others, he drops the ball on it. I'm fascinated by him because he's such a such an interesting character in terms of how he's battled up through the system. And I was actually working on his first state Senate race. I worked for his opponent, John Mahoney, and I knew, like 2 weeks into that campaign, I said to John, you know, you're not going to beat this guy, and he's going to be statewide before we know it. I mean, you could just see the kind of operation that he put together and kind of he's a little bit, I said this once to a reporter and got teased about it by some of my Democrats, but he's a little bit like Ohio. He's underestimated, you know, from afar. You don't say, oh, that looks like a governor. I mean, in all honesty. So I think people in Ohio kind of relate to him because he is kind of like us. I mean, he is underestimated, and capable of great things. I think somebody's going to write an interesting book about him someday.
If the election were held today, Acton versus Ramaswamy, what would the numbers look like?
It would be a lot higher than the polls are showing. It would be a lot higher because the polls are showing a forced electorate. You know, you always need to be cautious, no matter how many steps they take to weed out people who may not vote. There's always the good intentions, you know, oh yeah, I'll vote. But then, you know, election day comes and the kid's got the flu and you get a flat tire on the car and, you know, things happen and you don't vote, or you really don't feel the urge to vote because you're not that excited about the candidate, which I think is what's going to happen to the Republicans. And I think it's going to really hurt John Husted. It's going to hurt Republicans up and down the ticket because of that forced electorate. What you hope for as a pollster or somebody analyzing the poll is that you have balance between the Democrats and the Republicans who aren't real voters. And normally you do. I mean, because, you know, people have good intentions, and when they tell a pollster, I'm going to vote, they mean it, but they're not thinking ahead to the crush that, you know, of life as election day nears. And so you're going to have a chunk of Republicans that in the end are not going to participate in this election.
So if the election were held today, Amy Acton would win by how many points?
I'd say 15 plus.
Wow. That's big. Tell you what, we got to go to break, but we're keeping Greg with us here, and actually we're going to bring in Mary Ellen, and we're going to have a little reunion here on the air. Next hour, stay tuned to WGH Talk. Don't go anywhere.
Page, crtmechanicals.com.
3, 2, 1. Oh, no. Which button am I?
When every second counts, you can't wing it.
Guys, a little help up here?
In a home